Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
From Heritage Radio, it's Why Food, a show about creators, entrepreneurs, and visionaries in the food industry and the stories behind their success. Good afternoon, guys. Today I'm here with Darlene Scherer from Supercrown Coffee. Thanks very much for joining me, Darlene.
Hey, Patrick.
Darlene, you're only walking down the street a short little while, so you're nice and close to us here today. You're probably the closest guest we have had to the station.
Oh yeah, we're neighbors.
Yeah. So whereabouts is Supercrown?
Just it's, to let people know. Yeah, it's 8 Wilson Avenue in Bushwick, right at the corner of Flushing.
And for anyone that doesn't know, it's that kind of beautiful white building with massive windows as you come right on the corner there at the cross section.
Yeah, thanks. Get a lot of sunlight in there.
Yeah, you must have been pretty happy to land that location. It's a great space.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I was really looking for something that had natural light, you know. Roasters tend to be in caves.
Yeah, I was down on one on Johnson not too long ago. And like you said, it was a very much so a cave. You felt like you were in a coffee shop within a factory.
Yeah.
Whereas, I don't know what it is about Supercrown. It's just very welcoming. That space, you know, that you want to chill out and you want to stay. And the staff in there are great. It's my go-to. It's where I go for coffee. So I was very happy
that's
to
nice
have you
to
here
hear.
On the show.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a goal.
Yeah, of course.
Know?
Yeah.
And just having that energy, you know, like the people are so important and, you know, the staff like it, you know, and just, I don't know. It's good. We've got a really talented crew and I don't know. It's
and how
nice.
how receptive has the Bushwick community been since you moved in here?
Good. You know, it's I love Bushwick. I love the creative vibe that's happening here. You know, it reminds me of old Williamsburg a little bit.
Yeah.
And everyone's been very welcoming. The neighbors are great. You know, I love George from CrossFit and just the other retailers and stuff.
You know. So let's talk a little bit more about you and where you came from before we expand on the story of Supercrown. Whereabouts are you from, Darlene?
Like, where was I born?
Where were you born?
I was born in Buffalo, New York. I grew up there. And when I was 18, I went to college in Cleveland. And then, you know, when I graduated, I moved to New York, moved to the East Village. This was in 1994.
Right, and then just growing up in a place like Buffalo, New York.
Oh, my God.
Growing up, I don't know it. Well, yeah. What's it like as a place?
I mean, it's a nice place. It's, you know, it's working class folks.
Yeah.
That's definitely, you know, my heritage and, like, my upbringing is just middle class, working class. You know, and the people are really nice there. It's just a small town, and it's, you know, a little dreary. It's got weather.
Very cold in the winter, is right.
It's cold. It's just like always precipitating.
Yeah.
You know?
Sounds like Ireland.
Oh, yeah. It's just like, you know, and you have so many different ways to talk about rain and sleet and, you know, snow. And you describe snow.
So it's one of those places where weather is the very always the first topic of conversation.
And it's just in me. I just, when I don't know, I don't even realize I'm doing it. I just talk about weather all the time still. You know, I think maybe because I'm, you know, we're New Yorkers, we're always on the street and you're kind of like, how should I dress? And, you know, should I wear these shoes or whatever? But I'm, yeah, when I wake up, I look at the weather. It's just, I can't shake it. But.
And then what led you to go to Cleveland and what did you study there?
I mean, I studied English and art history. I just went there because my parents were really protective and didn't want me to go away to college. And so it was kind of like, well, if I go to Cleveland, that's only a 4-hour drive away. And so, you know, they just loved me so much and didn't want me to leave. But it was kind of where I felt like they would let me go. You Great. Know, in hindsight, I'm like, why didn't I go to Hawaii? You know, someplace beautiful or whatever. Cause, I don't know. I feel a little bit like college is college, but, you know. You just go and learn and stuff. But,
yeah,
you know.
Become yourself. Explore the things that you want to know. And
also, learn how to learn.
Yeah, find what you're interested in. Yeah. Stand on your own 2 feet.
Yeah, because I'm definitely not using that stuff, but I am, I guess, a little bit. Like, a lot of stuff is informed by art.
Yeah.
And design and stuff.
Well, anyone who goes to the coffee shop now can see that because there's great design aspects to everything. Even
cool.
Small little details. I noticed on the soft serve how you've got the Super Crown for the S for Super Crown on it. Just things like that, you know?
Thank you, yeah.
Totally remind you of where you are.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
And what led you to study English and art history? What interested you in that?
I mean, I think because, you know, I'd gone to Catholic school my whole life and I think they're... and I went to an all-girl high school, and this might be an excuse, but, you know, it's definitely the humanities is big, you know, so it's a lot of reading and writing and, you know, and I just kind of never was a huge fan of math and science.
Yeah, no, in the same way. And I went to an all-boys school.
Oh, okay, yeah. Right, yeah. So, and so that's just, you know, my dad was an engineer, so he's, you know, obviously... knows math and science pretty well and physics, whatever. But I did try that my freshman year. You know, I took a physics class and I had to withdraw. I was like, this is like way over my head, you know? And then I just was like, you know, I got into the art history department. I got a work study, there. So I was, just taking and filing art history slides, you know?
But even then, what you went on to work in was even actually quite removed from what you studied in college.
Well, oh, yeah. I mean, well, then, so I moved to New York and, you know, then in 94, I just, you know, put on a nice skirt and blouse and I went to a headhunter. You know, I went to several headhunters and I'm like, I need a job and here's my resume. And this is, you know, I thought maybe PR, maybe advertising. I'm like, I don't know. What do you do with this degree? You know? And I didn't want to go. At that time, a lot of my friends were going to grad school. And I was not one of them, you know. I was like, I'm done, you know.
You wanted to get out into the real world as quickly as possible?
Well, I just didn't want to continue in school.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was waitressing, you know, at various restaurants, which was great, you know. And my dad just put a lot of pressure on me. Like, you just finished college. Why are you doing that? Now, here I am, right? I'm, like, justifying my food service life. But there was something I just really loved about it, you know? I just loved the immediacy of it, and I like the people who are drawn to it, and I think there's, like, a, you know, definitely a creative aspect to it.
And at that time was... What was the coffee culture in America at that time when... If you take, for example, when you... were in college and then when you had just moved to New York, was there an interest in it? Was it still Maxwell House that was on the table everywhere?
When I was in Cleveland, there's a place called Arabica. It's like a mispronunciation, but that's how everyone there called it. And now it's different. I think it's the same owner. They have it's a different name, but whatever. Anyone who's from Cleveland or lived there in the 90s knows Arabica. They had locations everywhere and, you know, they had an espresso bar and they would make... you know, lattes and mochas, and they did cold brew.
That in itself was totally transformatory for the coffee scene.
For me, I mean, yeah, I think I was I was drinking coffee, you know, and I had a little Krups espresso machine in my dorm room, which is crazy. It was just like brewing shitty coffee. But anyways, you know.
You have to start somewhere.
Yeah. but I just liked the environment of those places. And so I would bring my word processor, which is like this, you know, brother word processing. It's like basically a huge typewriter. I'd go there and I would like try to do my work, like kind of what people are doing now with laptops, you know, it's just, and I just really, liked the way it smelled and I just liked the energy there.
But at that stage, did it kind of hook you in any way, shape, or form?
No, nothing just beyond thought, just being a customer.
You just thought it's pretty cool what this place
is
doing.
Even, I wasn't even like, oh, I've really got to get a job here.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, I got a job at the music store.
You were just enjoying your time while you were spending it there.
Yeah. And then I was like, yeah, I didn't even think about working at Arabic. It's funny now that you say that. It never even dawned on me until now.
Well, sometimes that, you know, you set the seed early and then it kind of blossoms later on in life.
Yeah. But it's definitely, it was definitely the first coffee shop experience that I had that I, you know, that spoke to me. I was like,
but
oh, this is cool.
A coffee shop like that was unique, right? Because the culture for coffee was very much, you know, pick it up and go, use it as a kick. It mightn't taste that good, so you'll lighten it with milk and sugar or whatever, other stuff you need to put in there, maybe some syrups to give it a bit of flavor. But there was no, or am I wrong in saying this, that there was no real interest in, you know, the origin of the coffee, the flavors, the profiles.
No.
That is a new wave that's happened recently.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what was happening there. I was not that tuned into it. But, you know, like, so how, like, what was happening? You know, I got into the coffee. So I was in, you know, got into advertising, and then I got into internet companies and a graphic design studio. And then September 11th happened, and I lost my job, along with basically the whole studio kind of shut. And so, you know, I sat down and I wrote a business plan, and I was, you know, it was 2001. Yeah, September 11th, 2001. So I think I lost my job in like November. Basically, all these proposals we had out, all the people who are our contacts also lost their jobs. So I just, you know, I wanted something that had a value, you know, and I just kept thinking of like this lemonade stand of, you know, I'll make something and someone will give me $2 and, you know, like, and at the end of the day, I'll have all these $2 in my pocket, you know, because the internet was just so weird. You know, it was so intangible, the stuff that I was working on. And, you know, and we had been talking about the bubble bursting for a while, and then it did. And, you know, we're like, you know, I don't know. It just seems so.
It was quite a fickle industry.
Yeah, and it seemed pointless.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, now it's taken a totally different shape and whatever. But, that was definitely where I was like, I want to make something with my hands. I want to have relationships with people, like, in person. And, I sat down and wrote a business plan. And I got an SBA loan for what turned out to be Gorilla Coffee.
Was there a lot of other ideas running through your head, or was coffee the one that was leading the channel
right
at the top?
There were, yeah. I thought, well, I really liked Palm Frites in the East Village.
Yeah.
Do you know that place? And so I was like, oh, it'd be really cool. I love this like Belgian fry thing. You know, this is so cool. And yeah, you're Irish, you know, like we love potatoes.
Just make other forms of them.
Yeah. Just like every kind of potato. But, So I did think about that. And then I just imagined myself at the end of the day smelling like fry grease. I was just like that. I don't want that at all. So, I wrote a business plan, and I did a lot of research. I went to, you know, I learned how to roast coffee. Part of it was I signed up for this class from Stephen Diedrich, who's, you know, one of the head coffee roasters in America. Like, he makes roasters and his brother has a bunch of shops in California. But just like on the basics, the fundamentals of coffee, like how do you source coffee? How do you roast it? Different, you know, like different things you can do during drum roasting, which is a style that, that I do that, you know, a lot of people use drum roasting, and there's an air roasting, but, and so I went there, it was in Idaho, and I took this class. It was like 5 days. It's like a seminar. And I liked it. You know, I'm like, oh, this is cool. Like, I can make coffee taste different ways. And I'll, you know, I love the idea of sourcing coffee from all these different places. And maybe I'll go visit these places. And, you know, I just really love that idea, that global idea of, like, you know, kind of like how. And another thing, you know, with the internet, it's just, there was something about the internet that was hard to explain to people. you know, at that time at least, of like what
well,
you did.
Well, as you said, it was very untangible.
And I really love the idea, you know, when you're trying to like carve out your life and what you want to do and what matters to you. A big part of it for me was like, I just want to do something that people get and that touches most people, you know, and that I really love that about coffee. And I still love that about coffee. You know, this woman came in just yesterday from Indonesia, and she's got a family who has farms in Java, you know, and she lives in Bensonhurst, but she brought in some samples. And I just love that there's, you know, like, and I just met this woman who's, you know, she's lives in New York, but she's a Cuban heritage. And it's just like how you can talk about coffee with just so many different people, you know, and they have like such a, most people have a story.
And you can find a common ground with people.
Yeah, and I really like that a lot. Yeah.
Well, it's a very interesting story as to Guerrilla Coffee and, mm-hmm. you know, then later on what led to Supercram. But before we get into it, we're just going to jump to a quick break.
Oh, great.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Linda Liu, host of Feast Meets West on Heritage Radio Network. Feast Meets West traces the stories of your favorite Asian foods, from their origins to what they mean in today's food culture. Tune in on Wednesdays, 8 p.m. to hear my co-host Iris and I interview chefs, restaurateurs, and other food experts about Asian cuisine. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to become a member today.
Welcome back to part two. I'm here with Darlene Scherer from Supercrown Coffee. And just before we went to the break, we were talking about Darlene's upbringing, growing up in Buffalo, going to college in Cleveland, and then her starting career in New York City in graphic design and working in the internet industry until 9/11 and the dot-com crash came along. And then after that, you started a business plan, which in turn led to Guerrilla Coffee. What was the idea for Guerrilla Coffee when you opened it up? What was different about it compared to other coffee shops?
Yeah, well, at the time, so that was I was writing it 1993. Wait. 2000, yeah, sorry. 2000 and 2001, and I opened in 2002. So I was writing it. At the time, it was just Starbucks everywhere. Not even nearly as much as they are now.
Yeah.
And then kind of these weird mom and pop shops, you know, where they would have soup and, you know, they would do like eggs with a steam wand. They would make scrambled eggs with a steam wand. And, you know, it wasn't a place where, yeah, it just wasn't like coffee focused. There was no, in New York at that time, there was no one that was independent that was focusing on coffee like Starbucks did. But better.
Right.
You know, and so that's, you know, that's just like the marketing person in me, I guess, is like, you know, there's a lot. I think about this all the time. I'm like, oh, something's missing here. Like, there's an opportunity here. Like, you know, how could you stand out? You know, like, friends have like business ideas or whatever. And I'm always thinking like, well, how are you different from everyone else or whatever? And so I saw a huge opportunity. I'm like, I think people, and this kind of before the artisanal thing just popped in, you know, New York, but was really happening in Brooklyn. So I think there were other people, you know, it's just like in the air that we were all kind of thinking the same way of, you know, like, how do we make something with our hands and we're independent and we're local and we're making it fresh in front of you, you know, and does that matters, right? You know, and so that was the idea.
And that appealed to people.
It did immediately.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I, you know, I got a roaster. I installed it in the store. It was on Fifth Avenue in Park Slope, you know, and just started roasting. You know, sustainability in coffee was a big issue, you know, because coffee prices were just had been at such an all-time low. And there's a talk of, like, the land is worth more than anyone can make as a farmer. And so... so there was a big movement for fair trade and organic coffees. So, at that time, so that's what I was sourcing was all fair. I was just like, that's it. You know, like, I'm only going to choose fair trade and organic coffees. And if they aren't certified, I'm not even going to consider them. So, you know, and then telling the stories of those co-ops. So I'd have printouts like Transfer USA had, information on, you know, this is an all women run co-op in Rwanda, and the story about how, since they've become certified, all the things that, you know, the economics that helped them sustain coffee farming in that region or whatever, you know. And so we'd have, like, you know, today we're brewing this coffee from Rwanda from this co-op, and then have the story about it. So people liked that. And then we just, you know, made espresso drinks, and I don't know. Yeah, it just, everything clicked.
And it happened at a time where coffee was becoming appreciated in Brooklyn, because you opened this store up in Park Slope, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And was it soon after that that there was a wave of coffee shops that you saw that opened up in the
area? Yeah,
like
around the same time Cafe Grumpy had opened. They were a counterculture account, but then they started roasting maybe 2 years later. It was the only one that was roasting right off the bat. And then some of the other folks, like, the, you know, like Joe, the Art of Coffee, he opened up, you know, and had a nice shop on Waverly, and, you know, 9th Street was there. 9th Street was doing, like, you know, latte art and all that kind of fancy stuff.
Well, Instagram definitely made that something of importance.
Oh, my gosh, right.
So during the time while I was researching about Super Crown and about Gorilla Coffee and various coffee stores in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
The third wave kept coming up all the time.
Yeah.
What is the third wave?
So it's like, you know, it's transparency, you know, and it's like, third wave is like just knowing where your coffee comes from and telling people about it and preparing coffee a certain way, paying attention to details, you know, like espresso extraction and milk preparation and pouring and presentation of those drinks. And just, treating it like a, you know, a culinary item, like treating it like wine, if you're talking about like the varietal and the process, or, you know, or preparing it like a cocktail, you know?
Right.
So just kind of in line with like the...
And is this the end of the waves, or no, is there potential for another wave to come, you think?
No, I don't even know if, like, I feel like, you know, I don't even know. I don't want to keep saying, oh, there's like a fourth wave or whatever, you know, because it could go on forever. You know what, I can just speak to what I'm doing. So, you know, got all that covered, right? So we're just, you know, focusing on where we're sourcing our coffee and, just high, you know, like, well, the stuff I'm really looking for is like high scoring, really clean, really beautiful coffees, with kind of certain profiles, you know, like I'm kind of going after certain types of, flavors. So really like juicy, like fruity type coffees, you know, that are, you know, I love, a lot of Ethiopian coffees and Kenyan coffees. You can get that in Colombians, but I also like just sweet and balanced too. So there's that. And then, you know, there's that serious side of like, you know, just really roasting it perfectly you know, sourcing it in a certain way and making sure that the coffee is stored a certain way. And
speaking
then,
of sourcing, what do you look for when you're sourcing the coffees?
It depends, right? So it's like kind of country by country. So like in Panama, I know a lot of producers there, so I just contact them directly, and then we figure out how to get it, you know, who's going to import it, who's going to handle like the logistics of it. That's true with a lot of Central American countries for me, just because I've been there, and that's, you know, they're, you know, the people in Panama, I think I was talking to you about this yesterday, they're kind of like wine producers, you know, and so they have, you know, they're very at the forefront of, you know, they're getting that some of the top prices for coffee. And there's, you know, they're branding themselves, you know, these the coffee producers, you know, so like, you know, Alita Estate, or, you know, like Esmeralda, and sometimes people know the name of the family that's behind, you know, so that's really cool. And I love that. And so, but then it's different if I'm looking for, it really depends. Like if I'm looking for a Weiwei Tenango coffee from Guatemala, there are a couple, importers, exporters that do that.
You're clearly so educated on coffee. You know so much, and you've been recognized by boards within America. Was that just kind of through trial? Was that just by kind of immersing yourself in it? Because it seems that when you had decided to open up, now I may be wrong in saying this, but when you decided to open up with the business plan for Guerrilla Coffee, you had an interest in coffee. You saw that there was a market there for it, but it wasn't something that you had ever totally immersed yourself in.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Is that just something that's come through experience and through the years? Because
I didn't even know what I didn't know, you know, but, so, you know, I just was an operator and just like, you know, paying staff and making sure that drinks were made and that we were, you know, we got Whole Foods as an account when they first were coming to New York. So it's just like keeping up with stuff and then, you know, kind of feel almost like an ostrich. And then like maybe 2 years into it, like taking my head out of the sand, like, okay, wait, let's, you know, like going to join the SCA, it's Specialty Coffee Association of America, join it. And then, you know, and I got really involved and volunteered and stuff. And that's where I started learning so much.
And then because it seems that it's run like a business and a passion side by side.
Yeah. It's more, sometimes I feel like it's more of a passion. but then, you know, and then I was really involved in Roasters Guild. I was on the executive council for 2 years. I was a barista judge.
Yeah, I saw that. That's very impressive.
Yeah, that was fun. And so all that stuff just really informed what was really great about it. And I'd really recommend, you know, if you can join trade guilds, you know, the stuff that you learn from osmosis or just from talking to other people who are doing what you're doing in a different region. That's what I loved about it too. So it wasn't, you know, it's a little hard in your backyard, you know, maybe to talk honestly about stuff. But if you're talking to someone from Seattle or Portland, like, you know, there's less of a, you have like your wall isn't up as much.
Yeah.
Maybe. And so you can really talk about like logistic issues, you know, and that's like, you know, in Roasters Guild, that's like a lot of what people talk about. It's like, oh, you use like what kind of heat sealer, you know, which sounds kind of silly, but
you get to geek out on it because
or you're using this software that like helps you like track your profile instead of writing it down on paper and pencil, you know, with paper and pencil. And I was really involved with that stuff. And then I started traveling a lot through to Origin. I started it with Roasters Guild. Like I would just go with the group, and then I'd lead groups. And then I'd just go on my own because I'd, you know, started relationships with certain producers, but I would never call what I did direct trade. You know, a lot of people talk about direct trade, and there are people like, you know, Counterculture and Intelligentsia and Stumptown. They were, you know, forging these relationships and having contracts with particular producers and, you know, and kind of setting out what their criteria was for that. There's no like global standard for it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a company standard that they articulate and let their customers know. And it requires a lot of time, you know. So like Intelligentsia, for example, had Jeff Watts traveling almost 365 days a year, you know.
To go and research coffee?
Yeah, because coffee is growing all the time. You know, there's something always happening, you know, if it's flowering here or it's like it's being picked or harvested or it's being milled here, you know, you can just like globetrot and
for a place like you as a micro roaster, is where does it lie most of the focus of the business? Because as a customer, the connection is with the coffee shop, the frontage, and then you see the roaster at the back. But is most of the business, the operating business, is that done through the roaster and then selling your coffee beans?
I mean, it's definitely, it's the heart of everything I do, for sure, is like the sourcing and the roasting. Yeah.
And then you have that, that's almost like your showroom to kind of show what you're able to create
like
through it.
Yeah, I feel like the bar is like the stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're doing all the rehearsals and all this stuff, or putting everything together, and then, you know, and then it's like, you know, you're preparing your raw product, or, I mean, it's like a brew pub or something, really, you know, you're just like getting all your grains and then brewing it, and then you like have this whole theater that happens up front where everyone's like just enjoying it, you know. And that's kind of like what, you know, I think like what I'm trying to do at Super Crown is like, you know, being, we're serious about it. Like, we've really got beautiful coffees on single origin espresso, or you can get a pour over. We're just trying out a brewer right now that's that does, it's really experimental, it's from Sweden, and it does you can play around with temperatures in three different stages. So just, you know, I really enjoy that. And, you know, I've got Peter, who's roasting, he's really into that stuff too. And he really dials that stuff in and does a really good job. And so, you know, we learn so much about like, oh, this one coffee that we thought was like this, you know, like we have it on our cupping table and it tastes a certain way. And, you know, but you have a different variable when you have different temperatures at different times, you have a different profile for brewing, and what that imparts on the coffee, you know, is really cool. But then, you know, I just made coffee soft serve, you know,
which is beautiful.
Thanks so much.
Which
yeah.
Is so delicious.
Like, you know, sometimes then I'm like, and I just want to have fun with this too, you know, and like come up with kind of wacky recipes. They sound kind of crazy, but like, you know, I'm like, a lot of times I'm like, it's more theoretical. I'm like, that should taste really good, you know, and then, you know,
try and create it. Then.
And then, yeah, then let's try to make it work. Yeah.
You'd 12, was it 12 very successful years at Guerrilla Coffee?
Mm-hmm.
And then you moved on to Super Crown, and you started that from the ground up to 2.5 years ago. What's the major difference there between the two coffee shops? Or what's something that you've tried to create?
There's a lot. You know, geez.
We know you can
I
tell.
I just want to be, I don't know, I feel like I want to just be, I think the thing with Super Crown that's really important to me is being really current and being really nimble. You know, and just allowing yourself to change as the industry progresses, you know, and just when I set up, you know, that's like when you have when you start a company all over again, the same thing that you just did, you're like, oh, it's a clean slate. I don't want to make those mistakes. I want to do it like this now, you know, and so there's a lot of freedom that comes with that. And so, you know, being nimble was a really big thing. You know, from like our packaging, like I want it to be really nimble. I want us to be able to change and plan for stuff that we can't even
anticipate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Because I really, you know, I think what's driving a lot of what's driving this are producers, you know, the coffee producers and like the innovations that's happening there. And, you know, I'm so excited. We have a cascara soda on our menu.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's
which
kind
is delicious.
Of,
I tried it yesterday.
Thanks so much. Yeah. And it's like, cascara is like a byproduct of coffee growing. It's the skin that's on the, you know, on the coffee seed, coffee bean. But it used to just be kind of waste at the farm, and they would just, compost it or put it, you know, I've never seen it thrown out or really wasted. It was just like recycled, but it's kind of
it's
it's like a culinary thing now, you know, and we can use it as tea, or we can, you know, we make a syrup and then we add it to sparkling water, and
it's very refreshing.
Thanks.
I had it yesterday and a nice little cherry at the bottom. It feels like you're having some coffee like Manhattan or something like that.
Oh yeah, thanks. Oh yeah, the Luxardo cherry. Yeah, and I'm taking a lot of cues from, like, you know, the cocktail scene and stuff, you know. But also just trying to be like, how do we, knowing that we are going to sell these to go too. So what does that look like? But
well, I love the store. It's fresh. It's welcoming. It's just you describing it there as a place you want to keep nimble. You very much so feel that, because it is very current. And I love spending my mornings there and grabbing a coffee.
Thanks, Patrick.
And before we leave here today, I just want to ask you, what has the coffee industry given you since you made that transition in 2001 to come in and work in the coffee business?
Yeah, gosh, it's given me so... I feel like it's... I feel like it's given me an identity, you know, God, it sounds kind of weird, but like, I feel like it's just, I don't know, it's just in me. And, you know, the thought of like leaving it is, you know, I've seen people who've, you know, left a kind of a big position at a company, a coffee company, and then they come back to it. You know what I mean? It's a, I don't know. It's given me community. I have a lot of great friends who are in coffee.
Yeah.
And it's given me a creative outlet. Yeah. And it's given me a global perspective. It's given me the ability to travel, you know, and a purpose and a reason to travel, you know. Some, you can go on a vacation anywhere, but like just going to, I like going to places and having a purpose, you know, like I'm going to go. So, you know, it's allowed me to see all of Central and South America. Hopefully it'll give me a chance to see East Africa. You know, and then getting to know, and it gives you like an authentic connection with people there, you know, because we're doing commerce.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, and looking for partners, really.
Yeah.
You know, like people who are like, that's what I really love pursuing, too, is like people who are like minded, who aren't just, you know, in my neighborhood or in this little bubble that we live in.
Well, Superground gives you an opportunity to explore the world through coffee, and yeah, you get to see it through the packaging and through the labels that you have.
Cool, yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Darlene.
Thanks, Patrick.
And I very much encourage anyone who's in the neighborhood of Bushwick to go out and try Superground. It's a really great place, and it's a lovely place to hang out and meet people and try some delicious coffee. And very different coffee as well, done in different forms.
Yeah.
I also want to say thank you to Heritage Radio Network for providing a platform for conversations across all matters involving food and drink. If you want to listen to more podcasts from this station, please visit heritageradionetwork.org. Next week, Bill Brown of William Dean Chocolates is going to be on the show to share his story of quitting the tech industry to become a chocolatier at 43 years of age. If you enjoyed today's show, please rate and subscribe to the show. That small action has a huge reaction for the show's popularity. And thank you so much to you for listening to today's show. If you ever want to get in touch, please email me at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. Or you can follow me on Instagram at whyfoodpodcast. Until next week, guys, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.